It was a prosperous domain with four estates. Amel Wood was to the west, within Sestalia, and was far smaller, but well-wooded, as the name suggested. Both estates would put me at odds with my neighbours, I saw. That could be a burden or an opportunity, depending upon how I played it. It certainly added to the administrative burden I faced. But at the time, I didn't mind. The title and lands distracted Alia from discovering anything important about Isili, or her daughter. While I didn't feel especially good about continuing to deceive her, I also did not want to ruin her elation at the promotion. It just wasn't fair to her, I rationalized. Then I poured myself more wine. Chapter 9. The Business of the Order. The royal court left me alone after my investiture, apart from one small reception that Master Harterian hosted in his offices to celebrate me becoming a mage baron, and allowed me to focus on the real reason I had come to Castabriel, the second annual convocation of the Arcane Orders. I wasn't certain that it was the best idea to continue organizing when parts of the kingdom were still finding out that they were even part of a kingdom, much less no longer under the bans of magic. But Pentandra insisted, and she had good points. If we did not stay in command of how magic was used, things would very quickly get out of hand. Indeed, they were constantly in danger of doing so. Many of the temporary fixes we had established at the founding of the orders were coming undone and needed our attention, and there were already disputes and disagreements that were beginning to make themselves known. The temple complex we had taken over was huge, but it already seemed crowded. Perhaps it was the severed dragon's head that lay in the center of the main hall. Now, we had to put it somewhere, after removing it at Cambrian, that attracted a steady stream of onlookers at a halfpenny a look, or perhaps it was the large number of magi who had taken to haunting the orders in pursuit of work, research, or advice. But when you walked past the guards at the gate, you started to feel a little claustrophobic. The traffic wasn't just because of the imminent convocation, either. The Tower of the Arcane Orders had become a destination for itinerant magi, foot wizards, and hedge witches from all over the duchies. A local inn had favoured the traffic, and had even changed its name from the Cup and Bowl to the Sign of the Mage Light, Talior Wizard's Inn. It had become a local haunt for war magi between assignments and wizards visiting the Order's growing library. The Order was actually several smaller magical orders administered simultaneously under one roof, and the convocation would include high magi, low magi, and everyone in between. The leading magi of the kingdom would come together for 4 days to discuss items of import to our class. Not everyone would be there, of course, but anyone who had business to be brought before the order had made the journey. That turned out to be quite a few magi. Pentandra had pared my role down to giving speeches and making policy, for which I was grateful. There was now a full application process in place, if a mage wanted to apply to be granted a witchstone, with the understanding that it was highly unlikely to begin with, and that war magi were favoured. But over 500 magi had taken advantage of the procedure to put their name into the four-pointed hat, as it were, and apply to be raised. The order was slowly assuming the role of administering the qualifying exams for imperial magical training from the office of the court wizard, and we'd apparently hired 20 masters of examinations around the kingdom. And there were petitions for assistance from everywhere, requests for spells or magical help from mundane folks. Few of the requests were even plausible, much less doable, but I hadn't discouraged the practice. It gave a fine look into the innards of our kingdom's folk. I hadn't discouraged them, but I hadn't done anything with them, either. There was a petition from a small group of high magi to restrict the numbers of new high magi given witchstones, lest it upset the delicate balance of their nascent power. Oh, they had plenty of good rationalizations, but they were mostly barely disguised attempts at making their club exclusive. Dunsellan's name was on the list, I saw. There were several petitions from registered magi who were upset at what they saw as unfair competition from the high magi, and unworthy competition from the low magi. These were village spellmongers and resident adepts who had suddenly discovered their valued charters now merely meant that they were professionally trained, not entitled to all the magical business. Low magi, hedge witches, foot wizards, and other clandestine magi were no longer either illegal or prosecuted. If a wandering foot wizard was willing to cast an anti-pest spell for half what the villager spellmonger would, what was I to do about it? And, of course, there were numerous petitions from low magi begging more opportunities, more training, and more resources, and witch stones. There was a whole contingent who believed that Imperial-style magic was inherently flawed, and that Imperial training should in no way be a factor in determining who got witch stones and who didn't. Several letters suggested random drawings. Pentandra's staff had sorted and organized these down to a few concise issues of policy to be discussed in council. But I still had to make the rounds to all three of the major orders, shake hands, make introductions, and be seen being important in my silly hat. It was good for business. Luckily, at that point, I was almost universally liked. The high magi tended to be grateful for the opportunity. The middle magi were happy to be rid of the censorate and delighted at the opportunity to be raised themselves, and low magi were just happy not to be fearing for their lives or a visit from the censorate every day for simply practicing their trade. So wherever I went, I was hailed as a hero. It was nice. For a while. The foot wizards were the rowdiest lot, unsurprisingly. So we scheduled their raucous meeting first. Most were openly vagabonds, itinerant magi who wandered mostly because the need for their cut-rate services was never great in any one area, or furtive underground wild magi who lived in the wilderness or wastelands. A whole coven of hedge witches from Darley Wood had arrived, five women in tattered cloaks bearing baskets of herbs and mushrooms in token of their gratitude. Four of their number had been hunted down by the censorate before the bans were lifted. When I stopped and heard their story, and listened to their tearful desire to be seen as respectable businesswomen, not parasites, I felt humbled. I met a father and son team, the boy no more than 12, who had walked for 8 months from the Castali Wilderlands to take their place proudly at council as authentic members of their craft. They made their living magically repairing gates and bridges and warding them against wear, and they had fled the censorate every day of their lives. I was introduced to a woman from here in the city who had eked out a miserable existence doing magic for the beggars and paupers of Swamp Town, one of Castabriel's many slums, and doing so for the smallest of fees or free. This was the first time she had entered the city under her own name and profession. A hedge mage from Ramir, an undocumented spellmonger from Wenshar, a foot wizard who disguised himself as a barber, a village witch from the Delta country in the south. These, I knew, were my professional peers as much as any high mage. These were the people doing the work that needed to be done, in a small way. Most of them had an earnest desire to use their burdensome powers to help others. Nor were they all merely sparks and wild magi. A great many had sought out training or instruction on the sly, or had found books to teach them the rudiments of the art. There were plenty of former students at Ella, in Arion, and elsewhere, who had not completed their formal studies, but who had practiced without the benefit of a license. There were even, I found out as the liquor flowed, clandestine covens of such former students, where they taught Imperial-style magic without a formal school. I was particularly interested in those. I've always liked foot wizards, even though they were technically in competition with me as a spellmonger. That's not a common perspective in my profession. A foot wizard could come through a village and offer his services at half the rate, undermining a spellmonger's bread and butter, the annual protection spells every sensible family invested in. For the foot wizard, it was quick coin as he was passing through. For the spellmonger, it was half a year's income evaporated. I suppose I was a war mage far longer than a spellmonger, and didn't practice long enough to pick up professional biases, but I saw the foot wizard's order as being perhaps the most important of the three, and so I did my best to cultivate some relationships among them. That meant drinking. A lot. But by the time I was done, I had met everyone in the room, over 300, and I could even have named a dozen or two of the more important foot wizards among them. The middle magi were far less raucous. In fact, most of them seemed pretty dour. Many were wary of the sudden changes in the way they did business, even as they were hopeful. Others openly resented one facet of the change or another, and a few saw them as designed to smite them, personally. More than one reminded me of Master Garkescu in Beauvoir Vale before the invasion. Petty, jealous of their hard-won prerogatives, and desperate for advancement. This was the legitimate professional class of magi we had inherited from the censorate. Those who had made the journey to Castabriel had prospered in the last year or two, once the censorate's hand was out of their way, but that had led to hard-fought competition for existing business. While everyone agreed that they were doing more magic, they were making less money for it. A delegation of resident adepts from Rhemir had an elegant proposal to restrict professional magi to districts. A spellmonger would pay a fee to his local lord, or burgher, for the license, and then would post warnings at the bounds of the district he claimed. In the proposal, if a foot wizard or other magi cast spells within the bounds of that license, a simple fee would be owed to the spellmonger. It made each spellmonger their own spell warden, but it also gave the spellmongers an effective tool against itinerant foot wizards. They would be less likely to undercut a spellmonger with a spell for a half ounce of silver if the spell warden's fee was twice that. The Rhemirans had done a good job seeding the convocation with their plan before it ever convened, entertaining and instructing their fellows of the brilliance of their plan, with a few whores and a fair amount of wine. By the time they actually presented it to me, there was already strong support. While I could help protect the middle magi from the low magi, I could do little to protect them from mage lords and other high magi. A mage with Irionite could do a spell it took an ordinary spellmonger 3 days to do in a half hour, and charge half as much. Only a few high magi were selling their spells on the open market, but where they did, it killed business and spoiled clients. The high magi were splitting into two classes, I noted during the discussions. The first was the mage lord class, made up mostly of the war magi who had been rewarded for service with ennoblement, or who had reclaimed their forfeited titles. The second were those whom I'd bribed, or who had been born common, and who saw a witchstone as a means to a fortune, not lands or titles. It was this latter class that was the problem. Most mage lords simply weren't considering coin in their ambitions, but magi like Pentandra's cousin Planus had used their newfound power to aggressively outperform the unaugmented spellmongers in Rhemir. A partner in a prestigious firm of imperial magi, whose roots dated to the late magocracy, Planus had more or less purchased his stone outright from me when the order had needed cash. He was a stalwart fellow, for a crafty Rhemiran, and had even volunteered for the Battle of Cambrian, where he had used his limited knowledge to good effect. But he wasn't a mage lord. He wasn't a war mage. He was a resident adept, and he was getting rich on his magic. Planus had arrived the second day of the convocation in regalia fit for an archmage. In the scant months since he'd acquired his stone, his firm had outbid all of their competitors for lucrative contracts for upkeep on fortifications, bridges, canals, and other public structures in the Rhemiran River Valley. He'd amassed a growing fortune doing it. Further, he had expanded his firm's efforts as his mastery of his new power opened up spellcraft, once thought merely theoretical. He also revealed to me, the first night of the High Magi's convocation, that he had been using his powers for profit in more mundane ways.
When I was in Gilmora last year, I realized the cotton harvest was likely going to be diminished, he told me, over wine in my quarters that evening. So, I had my agents purchase as much cotton as was coming down the river and hold it. Prices were low, as some lords were trying to get whatever they could after losing their lands to the goblins. But when the Cormeran fleet came into port, 40% of the cotton they purchased came from my warehouse, at a stunning profit. I made over 150,000 ounces of gold this year,
he said, with a satisfied grin. That deal alone paid for the witchstone. I still use the price of cotton and barrow bell when I decide how much to charge at market. I was stunned. Who knew there was that much money in cotton? But the weavers' guilds of Cormyr needed cotton to produce the garments that were in such high demand in that sunny country, and Gilmoran cotton was the best. The magical connection with any number of wizards in Gilmora would give him the market price he needed to know at the docks. A lot more fortunes would be made once the array of tower mirrors was set up, I realized, and such valuable information would be available across the kingdom. Tanis wasn't the only one whose fortunes had expanded. My classmate, Dex, had elected to journey to Castabriel for the convocation, now that he had been raised, and in the few short months since I'd gifted him with a stone, he had become the most popular spellmonger in his barony. He'd arrived at Sevendor, clothed like an artisan, but he arrived at the Tower of the Order in a carriage like a gentleman, and was sporting a brand new, richly embroidered doublet and fine cotton hose. He even had attendants, two apprentices who seemed as awed by their master's connection to the spellmonger as they were by the tower itself. Master Thinradl, too, had pursued a career as a kind of wandering high mage. He'd been the ducal court mage of Alshar, a prestigious if impotent position, and had accepted a witchstone as a bribe as readily as his counterpart in Castal, Master Dunsellin. But after the death of the Duke on the battlefield, well, just after being on the battlefield, had terminated his employment, Thinradl had taken to touring the baronies of Western Castal and what was left of Alshar, selling his spells to interested nobles. "If I was a war mage, I'd been making real coin," he confided in me when I asked about his fortunes. "As it is, I've done enchantments on a dozen baronial castles near the front in Gilmora and in the Alshari wilderlands. I even made it back to Verone for a while, a desolate place now, filled with refugees," he said, wrinkling his nose. "But I did my part for king and country. I spent a month working with the Iron Ring, establishing and fortifying new strongholds along the frontier with the Penumbra. For free. I could afford it." But then there were the handful of mage lords, too, whose aspirations had caused them to ignore mere financial gains, and were now building dynasties. The news of the moment did not revolve around my investiture as baron, as I would have suspected, but the actions of a young war mage I had trained the year before, Hanalif. Hanalif had taken his oath solemnly after I had vetted him for character and skills, and he had then served for 3 full months in the Penumbra with Azar's Megalini Knights. His term of service fulfilled, he'd returned to his ancestral home and challenged his younger brother, who had inherited, with Hanalif's forfeiture of nobility, to a duel over the inheritance. A younger brother had challenged him in kind, and when the last blow was struck, Hanalif was a double fratricide, and the ruler of 4 domains. He had consolidated his control quickly, and secured the lawful rights to the lands with proper writs of conquest, but he had also seriously concerned his lordly neighbors. To the mage lords, he was a minor culture hero. Even Wenek, mage lord of the half-wild tribes of the Pearwoods, was appreciative of this riverlord's boldness. Of the 130-odd high magi on the rolls, almost 70 showed up for the convocation, including almost the entire Order of Hesia, the order of militant magi dedicated to the defenses and supply of the war effort. About half of the high magi considered themselves mage lords, and there was an unabashed sense that they should take whatever they could hold against their mundane neighbors. I was hardly the one to serve as champion for restraint. I had won 3 domains for service and 5 through conquest, all within a few years. I was a baron now, the highest secular ranking of all the magi. While I didn't have a stomach for conquest the way some of my peers did, I knew that my future would likely involve dealing with my remaining regional enemies militarily. I could promise to show restraint myself, but once you are put in a position where you must fight to exist, promises such as those are easily forgotten. In some places, the rule of Magi had brought unrestrained prosperity, as it had with the people of Sevendor and the Bontol Vales. Robinwing, in the central Riverlands, had prospered under its magelord, Forendal, as he had bought out the debt of his smallholders and reined in the power of the burghers in the town. But the magelords, too, had some complaints for all of their successes. The censorate, it seems, had taken an interest in kingdom politics. Their clandestine agents had been discovered assisting those who fought against magelords with coin, magic, and technical assistance. What they hoped to gain, I knew not, but they were becoming a consistent feature of such wars. Nor were their noble neighbours inclined to treat them as peers, for all of their ennoblement. 400 years of anti-mage culture was not swept away with the censorate. Too much of the nobility discovering talent in a son or daughter was considered a curse, a waste of a good knight or future lady of the manor. That was particularly true of the great houses, the counts and barons who ran their domains like royal dynasties, and swore allegiance and paid tribute directly to the king. A perfect example of this exclusion was Lord Drainus of Moros. Originally the oldest son to Rainus, Count of Moros, in northern Rhaemir, Drainus was shipped off to Alar Academy when his regira showed itself, with a stipend that evaporated upon his graduation, and a lecture never to return to Moros. His younger half-brothers had split up the county, leaving Drainus to eke out a living as a professional mage with little hope of better. That didn't mean he wasn't ambitious. Drainus had bided his time as a principal adept and court wizard for 2 decades, until the bans were lifted. He had successfully petitioned for restoration of his nobility, and now he was a leading member of the Middle Magi's Council. But he aspired to more, much more. He was actively agitating for Irionite, and rumour had it that he would do anything to get it. Drainus haunted the High Magi's convocation like a hungry dog, pouncing on anyone who left the chambers as an opportunity to press his suit. Nor did he make any pretensions of what he wanted to do with it. He had heard of Annalif, Dunsellan, and my own conquests, and he wanted to reclaim his birthright. Only instead of a paltry few domains, he wanted the county his older brother possessed. The current Count Moros was a lukewarm supporter of the kingdom at best. He had ruled his lands without much in the way of interference from the Duke of Rhaemir, and he resented the presumptions of King Rhard frequently and publicly. Loudly enough, in fact, so that several of his key regional allies had fallen to a range of mysterious accidents and ailments. Count Moros shut up, it was said, but he was not happy. Drainus was not particularly in favour of the crown either, but he hated his brother more. An entire county represented political and temporal power matched only by the arcane power of Irionite. Giving in to Drainus and handing him the means of his vengeance would be tantamount to starting a civil war in Rhaemir. But it would also give me, personally, a powerful political ally, should Drainus prevail. And installing a mage lord into a position that important would strike in the craw of the queen, which I saw as a reasonable countermove to her recent machinations. Drainus got his stone. The order got 50,000 ounces of gold and the promise of 100 more within the year. He immediately hired 4 of his fellows, well-schooled in war magic, for an 8-week term. I considered letting Planus know that the region's famous barley may be in short supply this harvest. Drainus wasn't the only one who got a stone. I had brought 10% of the Alca Alon's bounty of witch stones with me to Castabriel for distribution. Drainus was a strategic placement. 10 more stones went directly to War Magi, the Order of Horka recommended for priority. The other 9, 3 went to the Order of Enchanters, 3 to the Order of Healers. And the last 3 I gave to Middle Magi spellmongers who were popular, powerful, and men of good character. There was a lot of disappointment at the announcements, of course, but also a lot of celebration. The Horkan Order fêted the new High War Magi on the eve of their training and deployment by renting out the Mage Light and depleting its stocks of alcohol. The smaller orders were just as jubilant, if not that raucous in their celebrations. But when a fellow gets a shard of Irionite, he deserves to celebrate. I left the accounting to the expert coin brothers the order had hired, but I had just insured a hefty haul. As tradition demanded, a fee was paid or promised by the recipient of each witchstone, adjusted by discipline. The medical order's money fees were waived in lieu of 6 months' service at the front. The enchanter's fees were paid directly by the guild, and later collected from the new High Mage. The five new Horkan and Hessian War Magi would serve for 6 months, before entering into a 3-month annual term of service. They were still expected to pay a money fee of 50,000 ounces of gold in the next 2 years, or make other arrangements with the order. So far, most had made their payments on time, enriching the institution substantially. And myself, as head of the order, I got a cut of each fee, to the tune of 5,000 ounces of gold. To give you some idea of the scale, that's just over what it takes to run Sevendor Domain for about a year. 20 witchstones meant roughly 100,000 ounces of gold in my personal treasury. Extra. And the fact that my treasury was made up of snowstone, literally more valuable than the gold it protected, gave me some perspective on just how wealthy I was. Nor did that include bribes and gifts. It seemed like every mage lord wanted to flaunt their wealth with an ostentatious gift to the spellmonger, and some of them were pricey, like the sheaf of weirwood staves I got from Wenwick, or the magnificent gilded set of charges, a game I had missed dearly, which was a gift from Terlaman, which meant it had likely been looted from some abandoned Gilmoran manor house, but I was glad to give the gorgeous set a home. I didn't ask for the gifts, nor were specific favours requested at their giving. But that's not how the game was played. They would wait to impose on me for favours. But that worked both ways, too. To help secure their loyalty, I'd brought another couple of crates of snowstone to pass out, and considering the underground market price for the substance, I would have been less popular if I'd been handing out gold nuggets.
Everything in my new castle works better with this stuff, Wenwick assured me when I'd given him a 50-pound sack of pure white gravel. If you position the stones just right, you can extend the field too. I've been doing some experiments with our defensive magics, he bragged. A bit of this in the vicinity can make the nasty ones truly horrific.
As much as I enjoyed the company of my professional peers, however, I ended up sneaking off to the more subdued low magic convocation that night. I suppose I was getting tired of the increasingly posh pretensions of the High Magi, and while the drink was decidedly inferior in the lower chambers, the company was lively, and I had an ulterior motive. In the wee hours of that final night of the convocation, I distributed over 100 pounds of snowstone to the various foot wizards and hedge witches still lingering, drunkenly insisting that they'd tell no one I was handing away such fortunes. While they were still marvelling at the largesse of the spellmonger, I took aside three of the worthiest of them, including the head witch of the coven, and gave them small witchstones. The gift of the Alka Alon had included many superior stones, but then there were plenty of lesser stones, too. Even the smallest would boost a mage's powers by increasing the magical energy he had access to. But a war mage needs a big stone, as does an enchanter or healer. In battle, such small stones might be overcome, but in the hands of talented magi they could do great works. Perhaps it was a streak of professional rebellion, or just sympathy for the plight of this underclass, but I didn't see why just the Draenus and Planus and Dunsellans of the world should have access to that level of magic. There had to be balance. A world full of just mage lords would lead again to magocracy. By raising the low to the high, I hoped to keep the powers steering the kingdom and its affairs a little more honest. I didn't even tell Pentandra about it until afterwards. I felt a little guilty and expected her to chew me out, but she was surprisingly supportive. "You've got a good feel for people, Min," she told me the next morning when I broke the news. "You've given a lot of stones to a lot of people now, and nothing has blown up too badly."
"Dunsellan," I pointed out.
"We'll deal with Dunsellan," she promised, "but in general your safeguards have been successful, although meddling in kingdom-level politics like that is troublesome."
"I know," I admitted, "but the Queen started it, and this doesn't work against her agenda. Draenus is supportive of anyone who is supportive of him. He's a devious bastard, too, and persuasive as hell, and I fear if I did not grant him a stone,
he would have ended up on the steps of the dead god.
"I appreciate the wisdom of your damned contest now," she said, referring to my annual spellmonger's trial.
The winner of the complex magical trial was awarded a witchstone, no questions asked. As long as they took my oath and were willing to be bound by it, I would let them walk away with one as a prize for their mastery. This would be the third year of the trial, and the last two had produced some remarkable magi, my youngest apprentice included.
It gives them hope, to the ones who might consider seeking out tainted glass, if there was no other way.
The ambitious ones won't be stopped by losing the trial, I pointed out. There are plenty who would willingly slay their kin for such power.
I'm one of them, Pentandra admitted. If you knew most of my kin, you'd sympathize. My cousin Trinandra is getting married, Planus tells me, and that's started the usual vicious bitch-fest among the ladies of my house about my lack of matrimony.
Aren't you wedded to your career? I asked. I mean, what could a husband give you that you don't already have?
Children,
she said simply. That's what it boils down to. I'm wealthy, I'm self-sufficient, and I need no man's protection. But to not give my parents their heirs is an offence against the gods, according to them. They want to arrange a marriage before I am
too old,
she said bitterly. There are plenty of adepts in my line who married and still had successful careers. My mother can name 20 off the top of her head.
Oh, Penny, what
are you going to do?
They want me to pair up with a nice Remeran family, one of the old magical houses. I'd even consider it if there were more like planers. Most of them are idiots, though, glorified spellmongers who hide behind their clients and play politics like burgers.
Why couldn't you marry planers? I asked. That sort of consanguinity was frowned upon in Narasi families, but was regular practice in old imperial families eager to preserve their bloodlines.
You're first cousins, but your kids would be adepts out of the womb. Planus is like my brother, she said flatly. He's a wonderful man, Min, don't mistake me. He'll make some normal girl, a great husband, and Sarah a room full of brats. But me and Planus, no.
Their alternative is that I whore myself out around the palace and pick up one of you white-skin lords, she offered.
That holds some appeal. I've always liked you fair-skinned boys. But then they learn that I want to continue my research, and that scares them off.
Since Pentandra's field of expertise was sex magic, I could understand how that might intimidate a man. It had certainly intimidated me when she had sprung it on me. Hells, I was still intimidated by it. I tried to imagine Penny married to a castle-bound lord of any stature, and just couldn't.
What about love, Penny?
Love, she snorted.
Love is... Well, it would be nice, Min, but it's hardly consequential when one is considering marriage. Love would be nice, she repeated, but a man who I could tolerate would be nicer. A man who can tolerate me would be nicer still. Honestly, Min, can you think of any man who could take me to wife and not end up dead in the process?
More wine, I offered helpfully.
See? Not a one. The man who will wed me must be exceptional, Min. More exceptional than I've seen.
Then her eyes lingered on me just a little too long before she looked away. That moment stung my heart. I was the most exceptional man that she knew, and I was taken. In terms of status, wealth, power, I was at the top of the page, and she had helped to put me there. I knew she had feelings for me, still, but I was married. Happily married, despite my premarital indiscretions. From her perspective, it was better to follow me platonically as a colleague than pine for me like a lovesick girl, and for that, she seemed satisfied. But that did not fill the hole in her life she knew was there, and we both knew it.
"Don't worry about me,"
she said, sounding like she was trying to convince herself.
"My handsome knight is still out there, somewhere. I'll find him, or not. Either way, I'm doing good work with people I like."
"But what about your mother?"
"Mother can kiss my tight, bronzed buttocks. And so can my cousin, Trinandra."
Chapter 6.
Chapter 10 Wizard Work. While Pentandra and I had spent a week wining and dining the various orders of magi, Alia had been left to her own devices. In a big city like Castavriel, she had plenty to amuse her, and plenty of people who wanted to see her entertained. The Viscountess, who had courted her so aggressively at court, insisted on throwing her a reception after her investiture as Baroness, and I escorted her to the affair in a carriage the day before the convocation opened. Sir Festaran acted as her guard, and Sister Bemia came along to assist her. It was common for noble women of our new station to be accompanied by a nun for propriety's sake. Alia was still nervous, but she knew it had to be done. One cannot be raised to the peerage without it being a socially important occasion. Pentandra gave her a pep talk and a wardrobe to choose from, and for 6 days straight, Alia was herself wined and dined by the city's elite. I barely saw her. Between the late-night strategy sessions with Penny and her staff, and meetings with important members of the orders about all sorts of things, she was asleep when I stumbled into bed and still asleep when I left the next morning. I missed her, but she seemed to be bearing the undesired attention with great fortitude. We did see each other at luncheon, about halfway through the convocation. Three young ladies of her new station had thought that it was dreadful that she was dressing like a member of the petty nobility and had insisted that she be properly outfitted by the best dressmakers in the city. Alia stoically agreed. She likes to dress up, but she isn't fanatical about it. But she was a good sport, and it was my money she was spending, so she felt obligated to enjoy herself. It had taken a lot of effort, she informed me, over 2 exquisitely roasted quail. I swear to Trig that they're no different than the bunch of old biddies who used to buzz around the market in Beauval, she said, shaking her head. Who's marrying whom? Who is bedding whose wife? Who will likely be widowed soon? That's all they seem to talk about. And the parties, she said in disgust. They can't wipe their own ass without throwing a reception to celebrate the matter. Min, the sooner we get back home, the better. It will be you going back home, I reminded her. I'll be back for a few days, but then I've got to tour the front. You're going to be gone again? She asked in dismay. If there isn't going to be an invasion, it would be nice to know why. You knew that? I riposted. We've talked about it plenty. I know, she groaned. I was just hoping that your plans had changed. I hate it when you're away from Sevendor. That's why I made you the mirror. I'm not happy about touring a war zone either, I pointed out, but I'll make it as quick as I can, I promise. Assuming a war doesn't break out. See that one doesn't, she said semi-seriously. Then she got thoughtful. It is odd, though, she began, pulling the wing off a quail as delicately as possible. What is? Hearing your husband talked about like a hero, hearing the undisguised envy of those women who have boring old lords for husbands, and hearing you talked about in such admiring terms by the ladies of the court, your youth, your virility, your manliness, she snorted. Is my lady wife jealous? Your lady wife is perfectly able to stab a woman if she gets too near her lord husband, she responded sweetly. And if I have to go on too many more shopping expeditions like this, I may well do it anyway. Enjoy the pampering, I urged her. You'll be back to the dirt floors of Sevendor Castle before you know it. I'm starting to miss the dirt floors. I'm not even safe from it here in the Order. I've been overhearing your female colleagues fawn over you excessively. There were 2 lady magi speaking of you in very glowing terms, and even discussed me. You. They were curious about the spellmonger's taste in women, she said, a trace of disgusted bitterness in her voice. Wondering what kind of exotic creature you might chance to bed. Curious about just what that might entail. Speaking of you like you were a prize bull. That didn't really sound that bad to me. It's just the fame, I pleaded. Pentandra warned me this would happen. They aren't interested in me, exactly. They're just attracted to my fame. I know that, she said sharply. Isn't every little girl drawn to the boy who everyone knows? I'm not stupid, Minolin.
but there is usually some sense of propriety about it. These two were making some very untoward comments about their ability to seduce you," she said darkly. "It tried my patience. They seemed to think it wouldn't take much to convince you. I almost spoke to them about it, but that wouldn't have done any good with women like that."
"Which ones?" I asked innocently.
"Like I would tell you," she said,
her nostrils flaring.
"Don't concern yourself about it. I told Pentandra. She will deal with them."
"Penny?" I asked, confused. "Why would you involve her?"
"Because she is their colleague, not some plump little peasant girl who slept her way into power," she said viciously. "Pentandra will know how to silence them and their misplaced ambitions with a word. She's really quite adept at that sort of high-level, subtle social interaction. I've come to appreciate our complementary roles in your life. She protects you her way. I protect you my way."
"Protect me? I don't need protection."
"Of course you do,"
she corrected me sympathetically.
"You might be a good war mage, but you are a poor courtier, my love. Min, this is a different kind of war from the one you're used to, trust me. I barely know what I'm doing myself, I admit. But I understand the principles. Pentandra excels at this sort of battle, and she's coached me well. You are in danger, constant danger, of being hunted by a certain kind of predatory woman who sees your success as a prize to be stolen.
No one is going to steal my sphere," I vowed devoutly, automatically glancing up at the serenely floating sphere. Usually I just ignored it. Alia made a face and rolled her eyes.
"It's not that big green ball over your shoulder I'm worried about," she said sourly. "It's the two pink ones in your pants. I know you're a loyal husband, but you are still only a man, prone to a man's weaknesses. It's not a judgment on your character," she insisted, forestalling my objection. "It's a simple fact. The nature of your gender compels you to pay attention to pretty girls, just like the nature of mine compels me to pay attention to successful men. The fact that I am married to one in no way reduces the attraction such success holds, nor does my fairness blind you to me as Trig would wish. I will get old. I know that. There will always be younger and prettier girls around than me. I know that too, and more every year. My beauty will wane. Your charisma will wax."
"But that doesn't mean I'd pay them the slightest mind," I began, feeling very defensive. Too defensive.
"You are a mage, Lord, not a demigod," she said, rolling her eyes again. "Why did I find that so damn attractive? I don't mind if you pay them attention. I just need to ensure that any real threats, threats to the security of our marriage, are eliminated before they can take advantage of your weakness. That's where Pentandra comes in. I tell her about the threat from the women in the Order, and her job is to intercede before it bears fruit."
She finished a bite of ripe pear, brushed her hand on her napkin in accepted court fashion, and stood imposingly in front of me. She looked good after giving birth just a few months before. "And what is your job?" I asked dully. "Did I really have to be managed like an idiot child by the women in my life?" Upon reconsideration, I decided I didn't really want to know.
"To make sure you never have a legitimate reason to consider their proposals," she said, unlacing her gown. "Now, we have perhaps half an hour before your meeting. Shall we make certain you are well and truly protected?"
I stared at her increasingly naked form. I felt insulted, for my wife and my ex-lover conspiring to protect my virtue, no matter how sound their reasoning. But as proud as I was, I also knew they had a point, else Isili's presence would not have had such a profound effect on me. Still, no man wants to think that he is too immature, too weak, too insecure to... Alia had removed her elaborate gown in one swift movement, and stood in our chambers as naked as Trig had formed her. That kind of sorted out my thoughts on the matter. I had been working really, really hard, after all. Perhaps I was weak. Perhaps I did need Alia's protection from my own libido. For some reason, with her standing there naked in front of me, that prospect did not seem quite as insulting as before. She tossed her hair sassily over her shoulder,
That settled matters. I defer to my lady wife's judgment in such things. I decided.
That shows uncommonly good sense on your part.
She agreed.
Now, come here. I don't want you to be late.
I smirked as I pulled my tunic over my head. I'm the spellmonger. I can be late. Who are they going to complain to? One of the final acts of the convocation was the official opening of the Hall of Mirrors. That was what we called the big storeroom we had transformed into an arcane communications hub. I had commissioned a dozen identical opaque white glass basins from a thaumaturgical glassblower in Ostley, and had them delivered to the order before I arrived. I also had wooden racks built to hold them, with spaces for small chunks of snowstone to augment the enchantment. Within each was one of the magical devices we created, based on a sympathy stone and other arcane material. Each basin was labelled clearly with the tower it connected to. Most of the other halves of the sympathy stones were still in transit to the final destinations, but a few were already in place. We tested the mirrors for Sevendor at once, and with a little adjustment were able to get the ones for Inarian and Alar Academies functioning soon after. The others would be set to working as soon as their companions were ready. I was able to check the news from home through the link to Sevendor. Sire Kay was summoned to the basin from elsewhere in the castle, where he assured me that all was well and that everything was working smoothly. There were no peasant uprisings, revolts of the petty nobility, or wandering monsters terrorizing the countryside. He was astonished at the news that he now worked for a baron, and he gave me his solemn word that he could be relied upon to take the appropriate steps. What those were, I had no idea. I paid to have the announcement of the new mirror service made in every market square in the city, and soon the business started to trickle in to the Hall of Mirrors. I stayed around to make sure that the system we'd worked out actually worked. When the mirror for Tudri became active, I figured my job, such as it was done. A final reception at the order to close out the convocation, and we were done. At the end of the festivities, Alia and I were more than ready to go home. She was just dreading the long barge ride upriver. For that, at least, I had an answer. A surprise that would spare her the trip. Because I had another issue that needed solving. The issue of my gold. A lot of gold. Most people don't think of the problems of the rich as problems. If you have gold, food, shelter, beer, and a willing companion, good clothes on your body, and a horse to ride, what kind of problems could you have? I'd always considered having too much gold like being too handsome or too strong. It turns out that having as much gold as I did was a problem. The order had a treasury room, left over from its days as a temple. That room was now packed with gold and silver paid out to the order for official fees, licenses, and such. It was a big room, and it was nearly full. By Pentandra's accounting, I was due nearly 100,000 ounces of gold from the last year. That's a lot of gold, more than you can carry around very easily. While the order was happy to store it for me, it was starting to clutter the place. It was secure enough. The place was warded up tighter than a duke's daughter. Some could be deposited with the coin brethren of Ifnia and other temples, who would issue me a letter of credit. But the monks would take no more than 30,000 ounces at a time from anyone. They just didn't have room for it all either, not even in the great temple that served the entire kingdom. Castabriel is a very busy commercial city, and there was a lot of gold and silver flowing in and out. They couldn't afford to take more than 30,000 ounces of gold for anyone. The order had the same problem. The treasury was currently packed. So to make more room, and get the use of those funds, they needed to be taken back to Sevendor. At least some of them. I settled on moving 30,000, leaving 30,000 on deposit with the Coin Brothers, and leaving 30,000 in trust with the Order. Next year would be even bigger, the way I was handing out Irionite. If I didn't make some room, things would get complicated. But moving even 30,000 ounces of gold is expensive. That much loot tempts anyone. To move it 4 or 5 days upriver, even with me guarding it, would require additional guards at various points. Or, conversely, we could just transport it through the Alka Alon waypoints.
Dara came up with the idea. She'd been listening with fascination to every bit of magical lore that fell from Alka Alon's lips, and Lady Fallowen had mentioned repeatedly how Castabriel was built on the site of an old Alka Alon settlement of some size. Since most of those outposts had transfer points, allowing magical transport between them, she reasoned that the transfer point for ancient Castabriel was likely still around. Lady Fallowen admitted that it was true, and with a little gentle prompting, she located it, in the cellar of a shop in the Chandler's district, near the market square. I sent Sir Festaren to negotiate with the shopkeeper, who wasn't happy about dealing with a mage, and in the end Sir Fess used some initiative and purchased the entire shop outright to secure use of the cellar, then rented it back to the Chandler at a reasonable price. The night we left, I hired 6 sturdy student war magi who were hanging around the mage light, and with each pair bearing a huge chest full of coin between them, took my gold to the cellar. I went with them myself, a wand in each hand, ready for a fight. None came. I was joined by my family soon after, and once Menalion was safely in Alia's arms and Almina in Dara's, and Festaren was ready, we had Lady Fallowen transport the lot of us back to Les Gaethiel in an instant. The rest of our party would travel back conventionally, with Bannermore seeing to the luggage. We emerged from the magical transport on the top of Matten's Helm, within the courtyard of the graceful Alcan Spire. Lady Ithalia was on hand to greet us, smiling and bidding us welcome. "That," Alia said, as she finished throwing up, "was much better than 4 days on a barge. We should travel like that every time." "That is a very special spell reserved only for the biggest emergencies," I countered, as I wiped the vomit from my own lips. "But getting here without spending 10% of the gold on guards was worth it." "You're just going to leave it here?" she asked, as I started down the trail. I shrugged. "The only ones who come up here are Alka Alon and Karshak Alon. The Alka don't use gold. The Karshak only use it for ornamentation. I'll have some of Master Guri's folk bring it to the treasury in the morning." I glanced over the edge of the little mountain and saw plenty of lights still on in the village below. I hadn't realized just how much I had missed home. "Race you to the holly bush for a pint?" Sevendor was no worse for wear in my absence, I noted the next morning at breakfast in my tower. The progress on the new castle was impressive. A massive wooden scaffold was being assembled up the face of the cliff behind the castle, as the first deep tunnels were being prepared. There were over 200 Karshak masons from Guri's Lodge working on it now, with another 200 supposed to come at various points to finish off particular parts. It would still be years before it was inhabitable, let alone finished, but they were making progress, and that was encouraging. As far as the farming went, this was a lazy time of year. The ploughing and planting was done, and there was little left in the agricultural year but to weed, water, and keep the rabbits at bay. With the Chepstone Fair just passed, and the Sevendor Magical Fair to look forward to in the autumn, there just wasn't much pressing to be done at the moment. The biggest change was actually in Sire Kay, who was beside himself over my investiture. Only the birth of his son Kestron, at his estate of Carguenion, a few weeks after Almina was born, was more exciting to him. He saw my being raised as a baron as some sort of personal vindication, and he had already started spreading the word and ordering baronial regalia to suit our new office. "There is much yet to do," he cautioned me, ever wary of regional politics. "Of course, I notified Baron Arathaniel at once. He will be saddened over the loss of a potential vassal, but he should be supportive." "I'll say. I helped win him a handful of lost domains," I agreed. "I would never swear fealty to the man anyway. I like him, but Sevendor doesn't need another overlord. But then there is the matter of Sashtalia and East Flaria, both of whom may see the appointment as a threat, particularly considering where your new lands lie. They will contend with the new reality in due time," I prophesied. "After the drubbing I gave the Warbird, they won't be too eager to mess with Sevendor. Then there is the matter of your official investiture celebration," he pointed out. "To be raised to such a station and not invite the regional lords to celebrate would be seen as rude and presumptuous. I wouldn't want to seem rude or presumptuous, I said, unconvincingly. Just so. Traditionally, this is a tournament of some sort, he continued. I would suggest something concurrent with the magic fair. We will have the common set for a festival anyway. Make it happen, I agreed. It's about time Sevendor hosted a tournament. Lights, jousting, no professionals. Keep the prizes low to discourage ringers. But where to hold it? Not in the Outer Bailey. Not suitable at all, sire. He agreed. I shall see if we cannot make a decent list field in the lowlands of the Southridge Manor. There are a few spots there that would make a satisfactory tournament field. It's pretty out there, too. Right in the middle of the vale. All right. Set it up. Couldn't hurt attendance, either. Do you really think Arathaniel will be bent out of shape? He does have dreams of re-establishing his family's control of the Bontol Valley, Sire Kay assured me. Having a new barony pop up on his southern border keeps that from his grasp. But he has opponents to fight elsewhere, before he would ever turn his attention to Sevendor. I think if he is assured of Sevendor's alliance, he will put a good face upon the deed and forget his ambition. I will have to investigate East Valeria and Sestalia, he added, although it was clear he was as eager for a fight with either as Baron Arathaniel was to advance the Lensley banner. Not that Sire Kay was a belligerent man, but he had a professional knight's eagerness for dynastic warfare, especially against lords with reputations as low as Lord Trefalan and Baron Vulric, both of which he considered of low honour, thanks to the way they ran their domains. Now that you are back, I can attend to a few items back at my own estates. I need to go check on Estret and Little Kestrin, anyway, and a quick journey to Chepstow would not take long. I shall work in a small social call on Arathaniel, to feel him out. Just keep the appointment secret for now, I advised. Inform who needs to know, but let's try to conserve the surprise until the fair. I have maybe a week before I have to go back to the Wilderlands to start this tour, and I don't want to spend it fielding congratulatory letters and such when I could be, I said, struggling for the right phrase. Goofing off is the phrase it occurs to me the Mage Lord is searching for, Sire Kay supplied, helpfully. Summer in Sevendor also brought something else back, my two wayward apprentices. Rondal had emerged from the rigors of the mysteries of Duin a changed boy, a man now, in all but years. His shoulders had broadened, and his voice had deepened, and he carried himself with a self-assuredness that he had not possessed when I'd sent him off to Inarion. Tyndall, on the other hand, had seen his cockiness tempered with discipline. While he was just as ambitious as before, he was more cautious, particularly around Rondal, I noticed. The younger of my apprentices gave his junior a wide berth, even in my workshop. Indeed, they barely spoke to each other. I gave them temporary assignments to keep them occupied, but I knew they needed more. I was at a loss for what exactly to do when Sire Kay suggested he take charge of them. They have been trained as magi and war magi, he reasoned. They have yet to experience the rigors of chivalry. They need to be taught the finer points of knighthood. Let me take them to Carguenyon for a few weeks, and I'll put them through their paces. I'll even take them to Chepstow Castle, and let Arathaniel's squires have a few courses at them on the list field. A little errantry and grace will help to temper their spirits. That's not a bad idea, I conceded. If the war isn't heating up, you might as well. Just don't be too hard on them. They've been through a lot. Not at all, sire. I will focus on the social graces and responsibilities of knighthood more than the combat. I will do my best to turn them into gentlemen. Since the birth of his son, he had taken a more paternal attitude about a lot of things, but I doubted even his calm patience would be enough to keep the boys under control. Sire Kay, if you can, you're more of a wizard than I am. The three of them left a few days later. Neither of the boys looked very enthusiastic about it, but it was better than guard duty. In the few days I had before I left on my inspection tour, I filled with busy work to keep me from thinking about what was really bothering me. Isili. Seeing her again, and knowing how close to imperiling my marriage she had been, gave me pause. I was torn between continuing to keep the secret of her child or reveal all to Alia, knowing it would wound her. It was clear to me that Isali did not betray the secret to my wife, but the potential for destruction was still there. I could not ignore it. But there was damn little I could do about it. Alia, for her part, didn't help by persisting to be absolutely wonderful. Upon Bannimore's arrival the day